Blog Talk Radio.
Your host tonight is the eating disorder pro, Dr. J. Renee Norton. She comes to you live from Cincinnati, Ohio, home of the Bengals, the Reds, and of course, the Norton Center for Eating Disorders. If you or a loved one is struggling with obesity, anorexia, bulimia, emotional eating, or if you're just worried about food pollution, then you'll want to unhook and tune in.
Good evening and welcome to the Eating Disorder Pro Show. I'm Dr. J. Renee Norton and I'm the Eating Disorder Pro. Tonight we're very fortunate to have an amazing researcher, Dr. Stephanie Seneff, with us. She's from MIT and she has done some remarkable work. But before I welcome Dr. Seneff, let's just do a quick review. For the past 3 weeks, we've been looking at the implications of her work in the area of cholesterol sulfate. Dr. Seneff, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. And thanks for joining us. I have so many questions for you, but before I ply you with them, I'd like to do a quick review for the listeners. Recall, good listeners, that my doctors recommended an EndoPAT, which is an assessment that measures vascular efficiency, because my LDL cholesterol was high, as was my homocysteine. I also have the genetic marker for a vascular disease. In an 8-week period, I went from high risk of a vascular event to virtually no risk. Our guest last week, Dr. Stephen Lamb, who's been using the EndoPAT for the past 4 years, said that he's never seen a score over 3. My doctor's office said the same thing. My score went from 1.48, which is high risk, to a 3.04 in 8 weeks with no medication. Of course, Dr. Lamb initially assumed that there must have been an error in the testing situation, some sort of operator error. Possibly he said a change in the pre and post conditions. But when I reassured him that they were identical, and I also had to explain that my blood work reflected dramatic change, he was very impressed. Don't really think he believed the whole sunshine thing, though, so we have to work on him there. So for the record, the only thing I changed was to get sunlight or UVB light, as I've mentioned, every day, and I also stopped drinking coffee in order to bring down my homocysteine levels. From the research that I've done, it wasn't the coffee, as Harvard studies have not found coffee to be an issue in the development of cardiovascular disease, unless the method used was a French press where the unfiltered coffee grounds are subjected to very high heat for long periods of time. And that's not the kind of coffee I was drinking. In addition to which, I've been drinking coffee for 25 years, and it's only been the last 4 years that my LDL cholesterol began to climb. And guess what I changed 4 years ago? I stopped getting any sunshine. This is really amazing. Welcome, Dr. Seneff, and thank you so much again for joining us. I say this is amazing because I think you may have saved my life. Certainly,
wow.
It has improved. I'm serious. I'm dead serious. Certainly, it has improved the quality of my life significantly, and in a very short period of time. I'm on a mission to share this with other people. I want as many people as possible to know about your work, and I want to continue to debunk the myths about cholesterol. And I'm so happy to have you here tonight. So my very first question is, have you heard stories like mine before?
Not exactly. I mean, I certainly know people who feel like they've benefited from sun exposure, but nothing this dramatic. This is great that you did such a good experiment with controlled before and after numbers.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it myself. It was funny, when I got to the doctor's office, the young woman who was doing the test said, I was going to call you and tell you not to come in. I didn't want you to waste your money. And because this is way too soon to be retesting you, we don't usually see any changes at all, even in the first 6 months. And I said, oh, that's okay. I've been doing some things. I kind of want to see if I'm on the right track. Okay, so this
that's
is my
great.
Real first. Thank you. But I owe it to you, so thank you. I cannot tell you how amazing this is. Your research is just incredible. So this is my first real question. I understand that the heart needs cholesterol sulfate to beat and the brain needs it to work. There is sulfur in the air. The sun uses it to create cholesterol sulfate and also vitamin D sulfate in the skin, which the body can use to get the cholesterol sulfate and the vitamin D3 sulfate to the body cells. Every biological function is improved by the presence of these two molecules, as I understand it. The sulfate makes it possible for the cholesterol and the vitamin D to travel without using LDL cholesterol. So I get that. Pardon me, but this is where I get fuzzy. Why does one's LDL go up without the sulfate? I mean, what is the actual mechanism Or is that really part of another process altogether, say a function of eating damaged fats, too much sugar, unhealthy foods, or what I would call food pollution?
Yeah, well, you're actually right on both accounts. And if you think about it, if cholesterol sulfate is not being made in the skin, then it's not being distributed, and the cells are becoming deficient in cholesterol. So you need another mechanism to deliver it. The liver is going to kick in and start producing these LDL particles, which are shipping out and delivering cholesterol and fat, and also fat-soluble vitamins to all the tissues. So when there's not enough supply from the skin, then the liver has to produce more. The other problem, which is very serious, is the liver itself is being exposed to lots of toxic chemicals in the environment, especially I've zeroed in on glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, the pervasive herbicide, and aluminum, which is also present in there's lots of sources of aluminum. So those two actually suppress these enzymes in the liver that make bile acids. And bile acids is another way to distribute cholesterol. It's quite interesting because a lot of cholesterol is shipped out. In fact, sulfate isn't shipped out through the bile acids in the liver. And that eventually gets back to the cells. It goes through a very interesting path. A thing is made called a chylomicron, which is like a really, really giant LDL particle that's shipped through the lymph system from the gut directly to the heart. The first organ that sees this chylomicron is the heart, and the heart loves it. The heart will grab cholesterol and fats from the chylomicron, which it prefers, over LDL as a source of these nutrients. So when the bile acids aren't flowing, then the liver has to deliver the cholesterol some other way, which is by producing these LDL particles.
Right. Well, we talked about the chylomicron I think it's the first or second show in this series, and I have a PowerPoint up for my listeners. So listeners, you can go back and reference that. So just really quick, what are some of the sources of aluminum? I mean, I'm aware of aluminum in antiperspirants and aluminum cans, of course. Are there other really obvious sources of aluminum that my listeners can avoid?
Aluminum antacids. And aluminum in sunscreen. Of course, sunscreen is also often present in facial makeup. So, and anyone who uses sunscreen on a regular basis is exposing their body to aluminum through the sunscreen. High-end aluminum-containing sunscreens that have high SPF.
Okay, that makes sense. All right. So what you're saying is that the LDL goes up because it is one of the reasons that the LDL goes up is that there isn't enough cholesterol sulfate. So the liver has to work harder to produce this. And what
was
the other
method? Distribute cholesterol through a different method.
Through using the LDL. So does the fact that...
Which is really a second tier. You know, it's a second tier method.
Right, exactly. We weren't designed that way. We were designed to have the phospholipids, the cholesterol sulfate makes it possible for the lipids to be both water and fat travelers, so they don't have to use the LDL. So back to my history. My total cholesterol has been going up. I wasn't worried about that. We know now, most people know now, that total cholesterol really isn't the issue. My HDL was high. My triglycerides were low, so that's really great. I also had very good blood pressure, 100, 110 to 60 to 70, all really good, right? I even had pattern A. I even had pattern A when it comes to particle size, but my LDL has been climbing, as had my homocysteine level. In this little experiment, my LDL did not actually go down, but my LDL particle number was virtually cut in half from 2015 to 1177 in 8 weeks, according to Chris Kresser. Thank you. And it's all because of you. According to Chris Kresser. And others, it is actually the particle number that's important when it comes to the LDL. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. And actually, I can tell you what's going on, because what happens that's deadly is these LDL particles, they go ahead and they deliver their goods, and then they shrink as a consequence of that. They get smaller. And when they're ready to be returned to the liver won't take them. It says, no, I don't want you back. And the reason is because they've been glycated, they've been oxidized, they're damaged, they're damaged goods, and the liver doesn't know how to handle that anymore. And that's when you start to get atherosclerotic plaque, because it's a job of the plaque and the macrophages in the plaque to take in, to endocytose those broken LDL particles, which are the remnants, really. You know, the small ones, they've kind of done most of their job. They've delivered their goods, and they just want to be recycled. You know, they want to be taken apart and rebuilt again without the glycation and the oxidized damage. They need to be broken down in order to provide raw materials for new versions that are beautiful, that are healthy.
Right.
And so when you get lots of glycation damage and lots of oxidation damage, that's when you've got these small, dense LDL particles that can't be removed easily. And that's where the plaque has to come in and start removing them and using their contents to be repurposed by shipping them back out into the HDL particles as cholesterol sulfate, transforming them into healthy cholesterol sulfate.
Right, right, which is what the HDL is so amazing at doing. So let's talk for a second. I don't know if my listeners will know what glycation is. Could you explain that for us?
I'm glad you asked, because it's very, very important. And that's what goes on, of course, with diabetes when people have high blood sugar. It's basically attacking the sugars. Sugars are actually very damaging to the proteins in the blood, like hemoglobin can get glycated, but also the protein that's in the LDL particle can get glycated, and then it doesn't work properly. It gets this, sort of gets gummed up with sugar, and it will no longer fit into the receptor so that it can't deliver its good.
And just so you know, listeners, the sugar that we are talking about is literally sugar. High fructose corn syrup is absolutely one of the worst, but we're also talking about carbohydrates that end up as sugar in the bloodstream. And any other sources? Am I leaving anything out?
You are, actually, but you did a really good job, because you're absolutely right about the high fructose corn syrup, which is very toxic. What's interesting is that it has high content of a extremely reactive. Fructose is much worse than glucose, but there's another molecule of sugar called methylglyoxal that's even worse than fructose. And methylglyoxal, I've been studying glyphosate, and it looks to me like it's actually causing increased methylglyoxal in the foods that we're eating, such as the high fructose corn syrup. This is a theory that I'm working on right now.
Oh, cool. And where are we getting the methylglyoxal?
It's a breakdown product of the fructose and the glucose, and it's because glyphosate messes up the metabolic process in such a way as to encourage this methylglyoxal to accumulate. Very, very interesting stuff. This is brand new that I'm just now figuring out. I mean, I've been talking about methylglyoxal. I have slides on it from a couple of years ago, because I found out that it was high. It's high in Coca-Cola, for example, in carbonated beverages. But it also is produced by your gut microbes and even by your liver under certain deranged metabolic conditions, which glyphosate seems to promote. So that's huge, because the methylglyoxal is going to mess up the LDL particles, and that also makes them more susceptible to oxidative damage. So it's a real cascade downhill.
Wow. So that explains why soft drinks are so lethal to people. I try so hard to get people to stop drinking soft drinks. And in particular, you mentioned... Oh, I know. I absolutely know. I'm so fortunate I grew up not drinking soft drinks. And many of my patients, when they start out, are so addicted to the Coke and the Diet Coke. The Diet Coke doesn't save you, right?
No, but it doesn't have the methylglyoxal. Actually, I have a paper that actually specifically mentioned that the Diet Coke doesn't have it nearly as much. It has it, but not nearly as much as the... Okay. High fructose corn syrup Coke, so it really points to high fructose corn syrup as being really a bad source of it. But those diet sugars are horrible for another reason, which is that they totally screw up your insulin system. They confuse your pancreas and cause you to release too much insulin, which then ends up forcing the liver to release sugar and actually moves towards obesity, ironically. So drinking Diet Cokes is going to encourage obesity.
Exactly. So if I understand you, you're saying this is a combination of the methylglyoxal as along with the glyphosate. So the thank you. So the glyphosates are coming from the Roundup and sprayed on our foods, and the methylglyoxal is just a
breakdown
compound.
Product of fructose.
Breakdown of fructose. Okay, breakdown product. Okay, I'm checking notes. Breakdown product of fructose. Okay, that makes sense. Wow, that's interesting. That is so interesting. Okay, so back to the LDL particle number rather than the LDL. My LDL did not go down. Should I expect that my LDL will go down if I continue on?
I think it is in a hurry to deliver. I mean, I suspect you're in a cholesterol deficiency situation right now with your tissues. And so your LDL is rightfully so going to stay high. It's trying to deliver as much as it can. It's going to get improved in its ability to deliver as you fix these other problems. Are you eating an organic diet?
Totally. I have been for years.
Excellent. Wow. So you don't have the glyphosate. Well, I hope you don't have the glyphosate problem. It's actually not guaranteed not to be inorganic, but it certainly should be a lot reduced. So that's great.
Yeah.
And then you're also not drinking carbonated beverages. So you're doing a lot of things well, you know.
Actually,
which explains actually why you have the low triglycerides. You have quite good, and you have high HDL, which I feel once you have high HDL, you don't need to worry about anything else.
I actually
and you shouldn't think of high LDL as a bad thing. If your body wants high LDL, then that's probably, given your genetics, that's where it needs to be.
Right. I do have a genetic marker that would argue that I would have high LDL. I do drink a carbonated beverage. I drink a ginger ale that is made with organic agave. So am I still damaging because it's carbonated? It's still damaging?
I don't know. I certainly think that would be a lot better. You know, I don't drink any, but I drink beer. I mean, I enjoy beer and coffee as my drinks of choice, and water, of course. I don't drink fruit juice, and I don't drink carbonated beverages.
Well, again, back to my history, I stopped drinking the coffee. I wasn't really drinking very much coffee. I've had so much milk and coconut oil and grass-fed butter in my coffee that I hardly had any coffee. I didn't have regular milk. I had coconut milk. But I stopped drinking it to get my homocysteine levels to come down. Can you tell me, are you familiar with that? Can you tell me why the homocysteine levels and how homocysteine interfaces and why that came down so quickly?
Yeah, I mean, it's great that it came down so quickly. High homocysteine is a marker for some bad things, you know, and certainly it's a very much stronger risk factor for heart disease than high cholesterol. People don't realize that.
Right, exactly. Nobody talks about it because there's not a medication for it. So since there's not a medication for it, there's no industry educating us about how dangerous it is.
Yeah, and what's extremely interesting is that they did come up with a drug that actually lowers homocysteine dramatically. What they found was that drug didn't do any good. I mean, it made your cardiovascular disease worse. So they couldn't market it because the studies always failed. They said, oh, it's great. It's lowering making these great homocysteine numbers, but not doing you any good. So that's because it was preventing homocysteine from doing its job.
I see.
It was just basically turning homocysteine into some. I mean, it was just derailing. And a lot of these drugs just mess up some critical enzyme and just cause your body to have to come up with some whole new mechanism to try to deal with the situation because your body's always trying to fix things. And that's what's going on with homocysteine. Homocysteine, as you know, I think, is a precursor to sulfate. But it takes a lot of stuff to make sulfate from homocysteine. You need to have superoxide, which is an oxidizing agent, very dangerous. You have this oxidation damage in the artery wall. It needs vitamin A, it needs vitamin C, it needs ATP, which is usually sort of delivered by the red blood cells. All these things have to be in place, and the homocysteine has to be in a form called homocysteine thiolactone in order to be able to go to sulfate. So all these conditions have to be met in order to get the sulfate from the homocysteine. And whenever those conditions are met, I think the atherosclerosis site is going to get that sulfate, make cholesterol sulfate, and ship it out to HDL. So every opportunity that's available, it does that, but the stars have to line up correctly. Now, the other problem, I suspect, is cobalamin deficiency. And I don't know if you've talked at all about cobalamin deficiency on your show.
I haven't talked about it a lot. No, I haven't. Why don't you explain what you mean
because
by that?
Yeah, that's very interesting, and I'm suspecting cobalamin deficiency is playing a role. In our studies of the probable mechanism for the synthesis of sulfate in response to sunlight, it looks like cobalamin plays an important role. That
the thing
it fits into a pocket in the enzyme, and it holds on to glutathione, which is the molecule that's going to hold on to the sulfur atom that's going to get oxidized. So if you read our papers, it's all kind of complicated, but you can read there about how we suspect that cobalamin is needed to make sulfate using sunlight.
Right. I had always been taking the methylated B vitamins, they just weren't working.
Were you taking B12 or?
B12, B6,
folate.
And folate. And I was taking the not folic acid,
but folate. So you know about that too, because that's another whole story. But
right. So what I understand what you just said, and it makes sense to me about the homocysteine, I still don't understand why, if the body is using the homocysteine, why doesn't it go down when there's a problem? Why does it go up when there's a problem? Or was it already?
Well, so what I think is happening with the cobalamin is quite interesting, because if I'm right that the cobalamin is needed to make the sulfate, then but it's also known that cobalamin is needed, as you mentioned, to turn homocysteine into methionine.
Uh-huh.
That step requires lots of stuff. That's where you need the B12, you need folate. Methyl tetrahydrofolate, in fact. You know, you need that enzyme working properly, the MTHFR enzyme. There's lots of stuff that you need for that conversion. So if that conversion isn't working, then obviously homocysteine is going to pile up because you can't turn it into methionine. But I think it's intentional because your body wants to have lots of homocysteine ready and available in the blood to become sulfate whenever those conditions are met, because those conditions are tricky.
It's anticipatory. Isn't the body amazing?
Yeah, I think so. The body is wonderful, the way it adjusts to all these things, but it's such an assault that the body's mechanisms are really being challenged with this business of all this glyphosate exposure and everything else that we're exposed to.
Absolutely, absolutely. What about the role that are GMOs playing a role in that as well?
Yes, and I unfortunately have. I think the GMOs are a lot harder to understand and a lot harder to be sure about, because the science is really not well understood even by the experts of the GMOs, and the potential consequences of having these wayward genes inserted from bacteria in random places in the plants. To me, that sounds scary. I can imagine some really bad things that could happen, but I think hasn't been proven that those things happen. And there are people who are happy to say, well, you know, it's so improbable, you don't need to worry about it. So we don't know. I mean, just basically one of those things where two people can look at the exact same data, and one person can come away very confident that these things are harmless, and the other person can come away thinking, I'm never going to touch that stuff, you know? I mean, it just depends on your tendency in your mind to imagine bad things versus to just think, oh, yeah, it must be fine, you know?
We don't have a good enough case.
The studies have not been done enough. There hasn't been enough. I mean, it's hard.
There have been
virtually
no studies.
We're playing with something very unusual and not normal with these GMOs. And, of course, you have that BT gene, which is producing a pesticide. That cannot possibly be good. If you think about eating something that is a gene that can produce a pesticide, and you could imagine that gene could get into your microbes, because microbes are good at sharing genes. And that gene is probably not very secure in its genome, because it's been shot in as a bacterial, you know, it's a wayward gene that isn't supposed to be there. So it's quite likely that it's not that it might be freely available to mix up with other genes and get into the microbes, I would think. It's just like one of those things I could easily imagine could happen, but no one has proven it.
Right.
And then you would have your gut microbes making BT toxin, which blows up the guts of the insects that eat it. So you can't imagine that would be good for your gut.
Exactly. If it explodes their little guts, it's probably and there's this epidemic right now of leaky gut syndrome in the United States. I, for one, am completely against GMOs. Don't eat any foods with GMOs, and I think they're horribly dangerous and frightening. And I think there is enough research to suggest that they are very dangerous. There's no research, to my knowledge, to suggest that they are safe so far. The research that suggests that they are dangerous has mostly been animal studies, but it's really clear. And there are a couple of other correlational studies that are looking at the impact that it's having. But you're right, it's not really been researched very much, and it's out there so much. So
it's sort of harder. It's harder science than the glyphosate is actually easier science, because it really is just basic biochemistry and biophysics, whereas the genetic thing is much more sophisticated and complex.
Which is why we shouldn't be messing around with it quite so much. Let's talk about vitamin D3. So we have an epidemic in the U.S. of vitamin D deficiency. We have known for a long time that good vitamin D levels are highly correlated with good health, and most people know that you get vitamin D in the sun. According to your research, supplementing doesn't improve your immunity like getting actual sun on your skin, and I'm a good testament to that. The sunshine works where the supplement may not. In my case, my serum vitamin D25OH, which is the sulfated vitamin D, went from 23 to 31 in 8 weeks without adding any vitamin D supplements. I've never been able to get much of a change in my vitamin D level. I also have a genetic marker for non-absorption of vitamin D3. My question to you is, if I continue my regular doses of sunshine, can I expect the vitamin D to continue to rise despite the genetic predisposition?
I don't know, but, you know, I would think so. My vitamin D level when I measured it was 56, and I get lots of sun, and I've never taken a vitamin D supplement in my entire life, and I never will. I mean, I don't believe in it at all, and I actually think it's very interesting to me that we obviously have a vitamin D deficiency epidemic. Everyone agrees with that. There's no contesting that. And
right.
yet there doesn't seem to be this question of why all of a sudden is everybody so deficient. I mean, I can argue certainly that people are staying inside more. You might be able to say that because, you know, the kids have all their electronic toys and whatnot. So that's possible. Or that we've been so brainwashed to make sure to use sunscreen every time we go out. That's another possibility, right?
Definitely.
Sunscreen
is
very damaging.
Yeah, I think those are both taking place. But also we took the good fat and the CLA out of our milk and then added in the crazy vitamin D2, which actually apparently prevents us from even absorbing the good stuff, if we do get it, right?
That's interesting, yeah. I mean, I don't like to drink milk because of that artificial vitamin D that's been added to it. I wish I could just buy it without that.
Raw grass-fed, that's what I drink.
That's great. Of course, that's hard to get. I've tried to get that, and so it's, you know, difficult to get, which is a shame. I mean, in this country, it's so crazy that the healthy form of milk is the one you can't get because it's illegal in some sense, you know, or regulated.
Exactly.
Yeah, but the other thing that's really, really important, in my opinion, is the SIPE enzyme disruption in the liver. And that's what I think we have an assault on the SIPE enzymes in the liver. There are so many toxic chemicals in our environment that disrupt the SIPE enzymes. Those are the enzymes that detoxify lots of toxic chemicals, so you get into a real bad snowball. When your SIPEs aren't working, then that makes other toxic chemicals worse than they would otherwise be. But the SIPE enzymes are...
What are you calling them? What are they? What are you calling them?
Cytochrome P450, and the shortcut is SIPE, C-Y-P. Cytochrome P450 enzymes, very, very important in the liver.
Okay.
And those are the enzymes that make bile acids. They make bile acids. They detoxify toxic chemicals. They activate vitamin D in the liver, and this is absolutely crucial. So when there's all these different SIPE enzymes, but the same ones that make the bile acids also activate the vitamin D. And I actually think that there's a purpose of vitamin D. You know, vitamin D is very complicated because you make it in the skin, it's sulfated, you transport it to the liver, so it's delivering sulfate to the liver, which the liver loves, and then it's activated in the liver. With this, adding this 25OH, you know, vitamin D, and that's the one you measure, and that's the one that's low, so that means that it didn't get activated in the liver, which means the SIPE enzymes are broken, in my opinion. Then it goes to the kidney and gets doubly activated. You get the 1,25, and that's the really, really active form that's extremely, the receptors are very sensitive to that form of vitamin D. That form of vitamin D is telling that cell, so I'm a cell in the tissues, and I'm receiving a 1,25-OH vitamin D molecule, and that molecule is telling me, you know what, your skin is producing cholesterol sulfate, because if you know, that's right alongside the vitamin D sulfate, your liver SIPE enzymes are working, your kidney SIPE enzymes are working, and you are good to go. So it's a healthy, it's a body is healthy message to the cell.
And that causes
the cell to act in a certain way that says, oh, great, everything's fine. If you take a huge amount of vitamin D, which is what they're prescribing vitamin D to newborns. I know that because my daughter-in-law had a baby, and the first thing doctor says, oh, yeah, put the baby on vitamin D right away. Luckily, she said no, but I think lots of mothers are giving their newborns vitamin D, which I think is crazy because that's going to, first of all, distract the liver because it's got to activate all that vitamin D, which is going to distract it from being able to do the other things those SIPE enzymes do, like make the bile acids. So that's going to make it harder for the liver to make the bile acids. Some of that vitamin D is going to get through. So the cells are going to get a false message that everything's fine. But really what's the case is you've been jamming the system with vitamin D. It's just a totally wrong way to fix that problem. The problem is still there, but your cells think it isn't, and therefore they behave recklessly.
Have you heard of, or have you read any of Trevor Marshall's work?
Yes, I'm very fascinated by his work, and he actually is the one who says you've got to stay out of the sun, right? And you've got to basically starve yourself of vitamin D.
I don't like that.
To undo the damage. No,
yeah,
it's interesting because I think these people have become, what happens is you ruin your vitamin D receptors. You basically burn them out. I mean, they finally probably get smart and realize it's a false message and they refuse to receive it. So your vitamin D receptors become dead, you know. They don't work anymore. So even if you had vitamin D, you couldn't use it because you've basically poisoned them with excessive amounts of vitamin D. That's what I think is going on.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, that totally makes sense. I think his work is really good. He talks about how the receptors are, you know, the vitamin D is downregulated, and just like you said, the receptors are no longer receiving. But the solution from his point of view is to stay out of the sun altogether, and I couldn't get with that piece. I understand why you
said
it.
Yeah, well, it's possible. I know. I'm puzzled by that, too, of course, because I'm a total sun worshiper. But I suspect it may be that people who are in that situation as a consequence of having taken many years of excessive amounts of vitamin D, maybe mm-hmm. they actually do need to just rid themselves of vitamin D in order mm-hmm. to get those receptors to respond again, because those receptors are just not willing. Mm-hmm. I don't hear you. You know, they're just like, I won't. I know you lie. You're lying. So if you have to really choke them, you know, you have to mm-hmm. starve them of vitamin D before they finally say, okay, maybe it's okay. I can wake up again. You know, I think that's what's happening. They've overreacted to the situation, and you've got to undo that by starving them. So that's a way that I could justify his approach. Of course, he's treating people who have suffered
really
from this
serious
major
illness.
Toxicity
yeah.
response to vitamin D. And it's interesting, you know, the studies are coming out more and more, I think, that are showing people are so puzzled, you know, and it amuses me that they're so puzzled because it's so obvious to me. They say, oh, gosh, all these people who have high vitamin D, they have great, you know, they have great heart disease, low Alzheimer's, all these, you know, great immune system, all these benefits. So then they say, well, what we have to do is just get people's vitamin D high by jamming them full of vitamin D, and then they'll have that same lovely story. And then when they do the placebo-controlled experiments, it doesn't work at all. And they're like, well, why didn't that work? That should have worked, you know. But they're just being stupid because you don't get there by jamming the system. You get there by getting the sunlight and doing the whole thing properly so that the vitamin D has the right message. When it says everything's good, it means it because mm-hmm. you got that vitamin D through a natural process.
Exactly. Well, I certainly had good results. I mean, in 8 weeks, it may not sound like a huge jump, but it was a huge jump for me to go from 23 to 31. And I'm anticipating that it will continue to go up. That would be my...
I bet you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and particularly if you don't take any vitamin D, you know, ironically.
I am definitely not taking any vitamin D. The only thing I'm taking is astaxanthin, which does naturally have a little bit of vitamin D in it, but
that's probably okay. Actually, I don't disapprove of natural food sources of vitamin D. You know, like cod liver oil, for example. If it's done right, that's tricky because you can screw up the processing of that. But if you buy really high quality cod liver oil, you get a natural form of vitamin D, along with it's contextualized by all the things that are supposed to be with it. That's why when you eat foods. When you eat any kind of nutrient as part of a natural food that contains it, that nutrient comes in context. And that context is really important because everything that has this kind of hormone-like, you know, response, like vitamin D, is able to do that because of the context that it comes in. And if you provide it without that context, you really screw things up.
I use the krill oil rather than the cod, although I don't have a problem with the cod, but I use the krill oil instead of the cod. It just seems cleaner. To me.
No, I think that's fine, actually. I mean, I've read about that. I know Dr. Mercola promotes that, and I certainly have no reason not to. No reason to think badly of it.
So most people need about half an hour of sun to get the equivalent of 10,000 IUs of vitamin D, or only long enough for their skin to turn pink. I have a really hard time finding recommendations for those people with dark skin. Do you happen to know how much longer African-Americans, or can you point me in the right direction, for example, where African-Americans or individuals with dark skin, how long they have to be out in the sun? I mean, they have melanin, which protects them from the sun, in addition to which, in this country, they also have much higher rates of all kinds of disease, cancer and cardiovascular disease in particular. And I'm wondering, I'm making the assumption that very well may be related.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. I mean, I think it's, you know, everyone's skin is a reflection of their heritage and where they come from. And obviously the blacks come from a place where there's a lot of sun. And so they're in a place where there's less sun, and therefore they need more. And the same thing goes for the very pale-skinned people who come from the far north, the Nordic, you know, very white-skinned, who burn very easily and never seem to tan. You know, they're optimized for a very weak sun. And so they have to be careful not to burn. So you have your skin, your heritage. You know, unfortunately, the genetics doesn't work fast enough to fix that, that your body is expecting the sun of a certain latitude that your ancestors hung out in. And that's, and then if you move away from that, then you have to make adjustments. So if you're black, you've got to spend more time outdoors. And if you're like Nordic, you've got to be careful not to burn.
Right. Have you heard, so most people, I tell people, only stay out long enough for your skin to turn pink. And you can build that, you know, you can build on that over time. But have you heard any recommendations for the individuals with dark skin?
I mean, I don't know really what's being recommended. I would recommend as much time as they can manage because they won't burn. I actually recommend more than that for anybody. Anybody who doesn't, once you develop a tan, which I always try to work on a tan. Right now I'm trying to build up my tan because I've just been here in Hawaii for a week. So I have to be careful not to burn. But I'm trying to spend a little more time outdoors every day to the point where I could take a 2 or 3 hour hike out in the sun and not get burned, you know?
Yeah. That would be.
I don't want to use sunscreen, so I have to be very careful. If I get out on a boat and I'm not sufficiently tanned, I'll be burned and I'll be in trouble. And then I'll use sunscreen if I get in a situation where I absolutely can't avoid getting away from the sun, which of course doesn't happen very often. But I really work hard on building up a tan, which gives me more freedom to be out in the sun without burning in the future. So you sort of have to get credit during the spring that.
Right.
Allows you to spend more time outdoors in the summer and to try to really get out. I don't think, you know, people always say, oh, yeah, half hour and, you know, no more. They sort of think, oh, yeah, you've got your vitamin D up, you're done. Well, forget about that because what you're making is cholesterol sulfate. The vitamin D is just a messenger. So more sun is going to be better.
Yeah, okay,
you know,
that makes
and
sense.
I have always been a sun worshiper, and I'm, you know, I'm almost, I'm 67 years old. I don't have any issues with osteoporosis or arthritis or any of those things, no aches and pains. Very strong bones, you know, and I see all these older people that whose skeleton is just wrecked. I mean, a lot of them are sort of hobbling around, you know, they're physically weak and really look, you know, old, I would say, in terms of their just skeletal physique. And these people, I think, are suffering from insufficient exposure to the sun. The sun will make your bones and joints very, very healthy and strong, I believe.
Yes, I do too. It's been my experience as well, and I'm right there with you. Does a UVB lamp work as effectively as the actual sunshine? Because we don't get enough sun here in Ohio.
I know. It's a question I get asked all the time, and I would not say UVB. I would say broad spectrum. And often the blue light is missing, and blue is really, really important. Blue's been patented. It's very annoying, and so sometimes they have a, even like light bulbs, you know, they'll have blue light missing. Apparently, I've heard, as a consequence of this patent that they don't want to pay for. Blue is a very, very important frequency, and also infrared. So you need at least the infrared, the blue, and the UV. And I think Dr. McCullough promotes a particular full-spectrum sun lamp that if I were doing it, I would want to use that. Another thing I've thought of is using the lamps that they have for these, you can buy for pets. You know, there's these lamps that,
Reptile lamps.
You know, reptiles, right. The reptiles need both the infrared and the UV, and they have lamps that can accommodate that for them. It's very interesting that they need that, you know, and I suspect they are making cholesterol sulfate in their skin in response to these lights. But the infrared, the blue, and the UV are all needed as part of the stimulus to make the cholesterol sulfate.
Are you talking about near infrared? Near infrared, because I use a near infrared sauna all the time, but I was using that before I started using the UVB lamp and the sun.
The UVB. No, but maybe you can do the near infrared and the UV together. I don't know. I mean, I work at making sure I'm in sunny places. As I said, I'm spending the whole summer in Hawaii, and the weather here has been fantastic this past week. So I feel really good. I've managed to, because I had a rough winter. I was in Boston. And you know, Boston had record snow last winter. It was very difficult for me to get enough sun.
It did.
While I was there, but I've been building it up, and I'm feeling much better now. But
so you don't think the UVB lamp wouldn't be your first recommendation? You're saying broad spectrum. You're saying also include the blue part of the spectrum.
You need blue. Yeah, you basically need the visible light. You need the infrared. You need the UV. You basically need the whole spectrum because your body, you know, and I think it's really interesting that. our message, the medical message today is stay out of the sun, stay out of the sun. I mean, they're always telling us stay out of the sun. That's so crazy because you look at plants and how much they depend upon the sun for their health and for their growth. And it would be foolish for animals not to develop some similar system. It would just be ridiculous that a biological system living that long wouldn't have found a way to exploit that wonderful energy that the sun offers every day, you know? Mm-hmm. It would be crazy that it wasn't the case. And I think that, you know, we just have to, I fully believe that we do, and we do it through this sulfate, which is so wonderful because the sulfate captures energy from the sun. Mm-hmm. As well as, of course, capturing oxygen in a form that's safe to transport. It captures negative charge, which is so important for the health of blood. And then, of course, it has the sulfur, which is, like, you know, really, really healthy. So all of that is wonderful. The sulfate is so important for your health. And that's the molecule that the body makes in response to sunlight that is so beautiful.
And so the UVA, the whole thing about the UVA rays that are so damaging, we don't need to worry so much about those?
Well, there's another problem, which is, of course, again, in the biology. So, for example, melanin, you know, is protective, as you know, and there are these tryptophan responds to sunlight and converts UV light into blue light. And tryptophan is a product of the pathway that glyphosate disrupts, so it's likely to be deficient. So, you know, you can get in trouble because you don't have enough of these molecules that detoxify the sun, you know, because the natural biology knows how to turn those lights into exactly what it wants. And it's got a really fancy mechanism that does that. For example, there's FAD and FMN, which respond to blue and turn it into green, and in the process release electrons, which are going to create the reaction necessary to make the sulfate. So all of this is intricate and extremely well orchestrated by the body. To be able to, there's all these different kinds of molecules. Many of them are these aromatic amino acids that come out of the shikimate pathway, which is the pathway that glyphosate disrupts. So when those are deficient, then your body's not as well equipped to deal with sunlight. And that's when sunlight can become toxic instead of being able to be turned into good energy.
Right, that makes sense. All right, let's talk really quick about obesity. I hate to keep using myself as an example, but this is all very new, and I always test everything on myself first. I eat a lot. I mean, really a lot. I also, as I mentioned earlier, eat almost 100% clean. Since I've been getting the sun, I've had an increase in the number of – I've had to increase the number of calories in order to keep from losing weight. What role do the cholesterol – oh, yeah. What role does cholesterol sulfate and or vitamin D3 sulfate play in weight management?
Well, I'm surprised, actually, that worked so well, that you said you were eating more, and then despite that, you were losing weight. Is that right?
No, I was eating the same amount, and I had to begin to eat more in order to maintain your weight.
So it probably means your metabolism was higher. Maybe you had more energy, and you were actually burning more energy because of it, that you just sort of were livelier in some sense. It had a higher metabolic rate. What I feel about fat, I mean, I do think glyphosate is a huge factor in the obesity epidemic. We were getting fatter up until 1975, but then at 1975, we turned a corner and we started getting fatter faster.
Yeah. Right.
So the slope went up. And it's kind of been going, you know, we've been getting fatter and fatter ever since in the U.S.
Yeah.
And I think that glyphosate is a huge part of the obesity problem. And part of that is serotonin deficiency, because serotonin is one of those molecules that's by the shikimate pathway that glyphosate disrupts. And serotonin deficiency is linked to obesity, also to depression, by the way. And I think, in fact, some people get fat when they have serotonin deficiency and other people get depressed, and maybe some people get a little of both. But serotonin is really an important neurotransmitter and for the mood and for the metabolic regulation. But also, glyphosate, as I said, messes up metabolism, causes fructose to turn into this methylglyoxal, but also can cause fructose becomes problematic in the context of glyphosate, specifically because of this pathway that it disrupts. And so sometimes you end up with microbes in your gut that can convert fructose into fat, and they do that, and then you have to store that fat around your middle, so you get obese. But there's also a benefit for that because now you can sequester toxic chemicals, including iron and aluminum, you know, toxic metals. as well as toxic fat soluble toxic chemicals that are in the environment, like the POP, the pervasive organic pollutants. You know, you've got those things still hanging around, and your body can stuff them into the fat cells and keep your brain safe. So it's actually a feature. You know, you can get fat and store all this bad stuff in there because glyphosate is messing up your body's ability to handle, for example, the minerals in a safe way. So you end up, this is a strategy to help you.
It's a compensatory. Yeah, it's a compensatory mechanism that the body develops to protect us from the invasion of the glyphosate that we're getting it on all of our foods. And the glyphosate is part, again, to remind the listeners, is part of the Roundup. I mean, that's what Roundup is made from or has in it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's the active ingredient. Roundup has other things in it that are also toxic, but glyphosate is considered the active ingredient.
Right. Interesting. Well, I have such a hard time talking my patients into eating organic, but almost all of them want to lose weight. So this will help me come at that issue armed with the right
ingredients.
So I cannot thank you enough for being on the show tonight and for doing the work that you do. I personally am so grateful to you. I don't know if your experience has been, I don't know when you started your work and if you were always as well received as you are now. My hunch is probably not, but the work you're doing is so important and I hope that you continue with it.
Thank you. Yes, I should say that I only really knew about glyphosate and the problem with the toxic food 3 years ago. It's kind of amazing to me because I just basically dropped everything else and studied glyphosate, tried to learn everything I could about it. It turns out to be an extremely interesting molecule with all kinds of problems that it causes in the body. And, of course, now I've been eating 100% organic now for quite some time, and I'm feeling better as a consequence. But I do have good health in general, and I think that's because I've always been a sun worshiper, and I've also always worshipped high-fat, high-cholesterol diet. I've refused to buy any foods that label themselves as low-fat, non-fat, or any of those, you know, reduced fat.
Oh, me too. Me too. In fact, tonight
I've refused to buy them all my life. So,
yeah, right before the show tonight, I was making liver pate, and also a cream a curried crab soup with full-fat heavy whipping cream. not
wonderful.
Full-fat raw.
You're right. We're on the same page with that. That's awesome. Yes, great.
I think my body fat is somewhere right around between 7% and 9%, just a tad on the low side. But I eat fat and the good fats. I put about a fourth of a cup of coconut oil in my green tea every morning, and I'm part of a cow share, so I get the heavy cream every Friday or the raw butter every Friday, whichever one I decide I want. But yes, I'm right with you there. And it's so much fun to eat that stuff. It's so good. It tastes so wonderful.
I know. It's really sad, you know, that they take out the fat and make it taste horrible, and then they put in all that sugar to try to make it palatable, and it just makes a really toxic food, especially when you've got the glyphosate in there and all the GMOs and all of that. It's just amazing what we are doing to ourselves. And you look at the U.S., you know, we have the cheapest food in the world in terms of the percentage of your money that you spend on food, and we have by far the most expensive healthcare system, you know, and no one seems to question, well, you know, we always talk about healthcare and Obamacare and all this, but they don't seem to ask the question, why is it that we're so sick, you know?
Yeah.
They
well, I have
be asking
asked,
that
yes,
question.
I have been asking it and answering it. I've been working on a book for the last several years about food pollution and the impact that it is having on us. It was called, I've just changed the name recently. I'm changing the entire focus of the book to include this area of research because I think it is so compelling. It kind of pulls it all together with the work that I have been doing for the last 4 years. So the eating clean is awesome, and I found myself to be, I am an incredibly healthy specimen. However, I still had the LDL problem, and you solved that problem for me. You really
did. That's wonderful. That's really wonderful, and I'm really looking forward to seeing your book. It's great that you're doing that.
Thank you. And you too. Where can my listeners find your work? Where should they go? Do you have a website address?
Yeah, I do have a website, and I've put a bunch of stuff up there. It's people, P-E-O-P-L-E, CSAIL, C-S-A-I-L, Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, .mit.edu/ CENEFF, S-E-N-E-F-F.
Dash, did
and
you
I've
say?
I've got
CENEFF?
Slides and, yeah, slash CENEFF. I've got slides and papers and essays.
Yeah,
and
I love your PowerPoints and I love your slides. And one of these days I'm going to get to a convention where you are presenting. I can't wait to meet you. But anyway, thank you so much.
I would love to meet you. That's great. Thank you for doing this.
And you're so welcome. Thank you. Take care. I'll be in touch.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that's it for this evening. Thank you so much for joining us. And be sure to commit to be fit, eat clean, and live your life wisely. Good night.